Listening to Resonance 104.4 FM, I'm Morgan Quaintance and this is Studio Visit. My guest this month is one of the most exciting and original artists I've seen over the past 5 years. Across painting, sculpture, knitting, drawing and performance, the work of Hardeep Pandal presents viewers with lurid and cartoonish panoplies of floating signifiers, satirical transgressions and wry quotations from critical theory. Using these tools to parody and subvert the signs and signifiers of colonial history, national identity, urban experience and popular culture, the recent forms Hardeep's used to unify this approach are animation and music, or more specifically, rap that sounds like this.
Noble savage, violent noble savage, violent avenger, noble savage, whore and Madonna, vegan kebab, I'm fucking Donna, I want a Donna, I get a free Coke with my pizza, cause I look like Maradona. When I walk past, hold onto your bags tightly, on any public service, don't sit next to me. Building up the keyframes, oral history, blame the BAME on history, dislocate your masculinity. Allow me to introduce Pacavelli, rare breed, no chum in my pedigree. Don't accept me in my totality, only partially, as a cultural dowry. Test my gangster and bowdy bowdy, arrest my banker and wife's dowry. Gift you an inverted form of myself, you can keep me in my place. That's repression just with an emphasis on the trace. Yes.
In terms of graphic form, while the caricature of William Hogarth and George Cruikshank could form art historical precedents if you wanted them, Hardeep's work goes beyond mere social satire and is operating in a register that is entirely his own. Crucially, his approach doesn't follow the current trend for laughing at the subaltern, the working class or the urban whilst cashing in on the cultural capital these spheres possess. In much the same way, his approach to rap contains a respect and reverence for the form that underpins his experimentation with it. I caught up with Hardeep the day after his current solo exhibition opened at Cubic Gallery in London. The exhibition, which is open until the 3rd of April, presents a selection of work produced over the past 2 years. And I began by asking Hardeep what it was like to develop a show when the pressure to produce new work was off.
Yeah, I think it was sort of nice to present it like as a sort of a sense of a sense of like, oh, this is an achievement or a body of work or something. But I think what framed the experience was the idea of, you know, first exhibition in London.
Right.
So there's always a way of trying to frame something, and it's up to the sort of you know, the people, you know, like Cubit or myself to sort of do that. And I think I've actually noticed artists sort of doing that sort of reframing or selecting where they begin, where they feel that they have started their practice. And I think like there are different sort of, yeah, I don't know, I think that was the main thing. So
you do consider this the first show, because you had that drawing room residency in, what was that, 2015? Yeah,
that's right.
So it was a 1 month residency at the
drawing room
in August 2015.
Yeah.
And so that you were sort of in residence and your studio was in the gallery at that point in time, but
yeah, that was the idea. So you get a bursary and you use the space however you see fit. And I think there was a remit or a sort of a condition whereby they wanted to have like a public event as part of it.
Yeah.
And mine was just like a sort of conversation talk. Yeah, yeah. It wasn't so like workshoppy or educational in a conventional sense. But no, there was no pressure to sort of like display anything. That was a sort of an option. But the documentation and just the manner in which I approached the space, it's I think a lot of people thought that it was an exhibition.
Mm.
And we did an in conversation that was recorded, filmed actually. And the tricky thing about that was trying to sort of like come up with or say interesting things or useful things, but being conscious of how like how bad or well they might those things might age basically because there's no control over that. So it was a bit like it felt like a bit of a performance in a way.
And then you you use that in conversation in was it the show called Plebeian?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Is that right? Plebeian.
Plebeian Archive.
Yeah,
yeah. Like a solo thing in Glasgow.
Yeah, I like that. I like the way that you there was a sense of an awareness on your part about the nature of what it was that you were doing and then reconstituting. Sometimes, because I think what I'm trying to get at is that public discussions or talks, there's a sense of futility about them. Like you're not really sure what comes across to the audience, not really sure what it does for you as an artist or a speaker. So your sort of reuse of that seemed to take some agency over that uncertainty, maybe.
Yeah, and also it was the question and answers section, I recall, that I used specifically because in that occasion, on the video that they published, they didn't have a microphone for the audience, so you couldn't hear what the questions were. Mm. And all you could hear was my responses. So I thought, oh, well, I'll subtitle this and have that in. And then one of the questions was about sort of, well, quite personal, I suppose, about my relationship to like my mum or whatever in making some of the work, which obviously I, you know, elicit, but it was a sort of awkward moment, I think. And I think like, yeah. Also, David Dale, they're quite hands-off with the programme. So I felt like, well, I can maybe provide that sort of resource or something. Mm-hmm. I don't know.
So where did the title Liar Hydrant come from for the most recent show?
That's just like a name, a sort of a name, another alias rap thing that I might use. But there's no other sort of like base kind of reference. There's nothing. It's just completely made up.
I think that speaks to your like dexterity with language, like punning or a kind of lurid simile or metaphor and the rhyming couplet. It's like language is played with, is manipulated, is messed about. And the way that you then read it as a viewer, it's more dynamic than, like, say, normal titling, like someone being quite straight about what it is that they're showing. Because Liar Hydrant, obviously, there's the red sort of consciousness of the text, but there's also the awareness that, well, that should be Fire Hydrant, which sets off some sort of reaction in your mind, sort of cognitively.
It's also, like, in the way I approach making up sort of characters and, like, images, essentially. And there is like, a Fire Hydrant sort of character in one of the animations, and it's sort of... It's tangentially like related to the sort of one of the narratives about floods and like sort of the fear of like femininity. I'm gonna do that thing now. So it is tangentially sort of it's come out of somewhere, but I don't think it matters to have that knowledge. It's just a supposed to, you know, at the end of the day, it's like it has another function first or something.
So the exhibition pulls together a collection of colour and ink drawings, a sculpture that's also a bench, and a selection of four videos that were all like produced across 2017-2018. So is this when you first started to work with video, like the beginning of 2017?
No, I've been working with video since 2006, since I'm an undergraduate.
Right.
But it's only in the last couple of years that I've had the chance to... properly like exploit animation and like learn how to use that. But video, moving image, I've been making or been like had a relationship with for a long time, actually. Those earlier videos were sort of like I would appropriate or like chop up bits of ethnographic film, some of the dodgier ones from the like 80s, and like sort of it'd be exercises in sort of like appropriation art. And then since there was a bit of an interest in sort of ethnographic filmmaking and documentary, and I suppose also mirroring the type of videos that you would probably see at a big institution, whereby a curator sort of interpreting the work, and those videos would sort of parody that device, which I still do. And I think coming back to the drawing room thing, that's an example of that, I suppose.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, animation sort of self-taught since 2015, 16. So
right.
Since then, like, just, yeah.
And what made you decide to move into animation? Because for somebody that, like me, for example, who's come into your... I mean, the first time I saw your work was in 2013. As part of the New Contemporaries show of that year. And that work, right up until the sort of digital animations that you're making at the moment, the video composite stuff, sometimes with live action, sometimes not, that seems to be a real unified aesthetic, unified set of investigations. When did you start to move into that territory or that phase? Because it sounds like there was a previous phase.
It was 2016. I had a bit more time, a lead up to an exhibition, and I used the time just to learn, like follow YouTube tutorials. And I kind of acquired the like technology and the like, you know, software gradually through different sorts of residencies and like commission, you know, small commissions and stuff, and accumulated it. But prior to that, like the videos, and I'd always show like some sort of spoof interpretive video, and I would usually be in it, and it would be filmed quite sort of ad hoc, shaky camera and all that stuff, and I would present sort of comic-esque drawings, and then work collaboratively on one-off things, sometimes with my mom, sometimes with, you know, other fabricators and things, so they would always occupy the same sort of space, and I would always encourage that like variety of media, non sort of hierarchical, I suppose, as well in a space. I don't know, I just think like, you know, sort of having lots of like material stored up, it's just refreshing to be able to like have like a desk, you know, and I do it in my bedroom, the animations, where it's all quite tidy, and but like it's like an investment. I can make like a series of actions or cartoons or graphics and then store that and then reuse it in other things. So it's like the same thing as like an animation studio repurposing like a background or a set or a character. It just has a quite a nice sense of investment, whereas storing drawings is a bit like, yeah, I don't know, it's harder to do. It's like, you know.
Even though, say, the text behind some of the videos come from different like theoretical backgrounds, let's say like the text that might have inspired certain points of departure come from different backgrounds. It feels to me like the videos, the four videos presented in the show yesterday that I've seen so far as well, are quite episodic, and maybe that feeling is there because there are recurring characters.
Yeah,
I mean, one in particular is the character, the bearded character in the turban. Can you explain who this character is? Yeah, disrobe first, like, just for listeners, Hardy.
I'm just taking off my clothes.
Yeah, he's taking off the clothes. We're in like a tiny studio upstairs in residence where we have to be careful not to bash each other's knees. but yeah, now you've disrobed. Like, who's that character?
I guess it's funny because I come from a sort of Sikh family, but I would sort of say it's secular sort of household. It's not sort of strict or I was never sort of forced or encouraged to sort of like practice the religion, I suppose, but it's like the secular sort of Sikh figure. The initial sort of drawings came about from a sort of fixation that I had on the idea of a British sort of Sikh soldier or colonial soldier, essentially sort of recruited to sort of fight against themselves or something. That's the basic idea. So there's a sense of like split sort of subjectivity or whatnot. But also when I was, I suppose like the biggest sort of political like, or the biggest sort of event that happened during my sort of like late teens, or you know, before I went to art school or whatever, was 9/11. So the whole you know, war on terror thing kind of lent the idea of a sort of Asiatic like bearded sort of turban character, it kind of made it not really about the Sikh soldier. It sort of had this other dimension to it. And it's interesting how, you know, in different parts of the world, people can look at some of those drawings and, you know, not be sure whether it's a sort of a terrorist kind of caricature, whether it's a sort of, you know, self-portrait even. Mm-hmm. So it's like a fluid, like, kind of decoy sort of thing, which I use, yeah, in quite loose and fluid ways, I suppose. But yeah, I mean, with the 9/11 thing, it's like in America there were stories of people carrying out acts of like vengeance on sort of Sikh men and whatever. So yeah, I don't know. I think it just points to that, like, what constitutes these people essentially. That's the basic sort of question, isn't it?
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned the word decoy, because it feels to me like a lot of your work is about deploying decoys. Whether the decoy is a metaphor, whether the decoy is like a pun, I think maybe an easy way of talking about it would be to say, oh, you use the register of irony. So things have a double meaning. But I think the decoys are much more apt, because there does seem to be some sort of critical intent that's happening. And so the work isn't just duping the viewer into thinking something or not being sure about your position, your commitment to a certain idea, but it is about having this thing detonate in the mind of the viewer, having something that can be viewed in a number of different ways detonate in the mind of the viewer once they start to unpack it. So even with the title Liar Hydrant, there is a degree of like involuntary unpacking, isn't there? Because it says Liar Hydrant, but I'm thinking Fire Hydrant, right?
Yeah, I mean, I'm trying to figure out whether there's a sort of, I would say that one of the foundational and like maybe recurring sort of attitude is I'm quite suspicious of the things that I'm involved in, because maybe less so now, or I don't know, but I think like I initially was on a lot of those works, or the starting point, you know, was a lot of these things happened when I had no support really, or very little support, and I was just working with my friends who I still work with. And it's just circulating, and as I'm getting a bit more feedback and, you know, obviously learning and reading more about other things, I suppose I want it to precede me essentially. You know, like it should have a some sort of cultural significance, I suppose. But I can't really be. I want the feedback to also perhaps have a effect on the work or something.
And does like your friendship group provide that feedback to you? Is it?
Yeah, definitely. One of my friends, who's an artist called David Steens, we worked together a long time in Leeds, actually, and we still sort of do stuff. But he's featured in a lot of videos as a sort of form of resistance or like a foil. But it's not really about his work. It's just he's around. So and then, yeah, it's like with any practice, I suppose. You have an informal bunch of people that you just share your work to before it might go out more publicly.
What's some of the feedback that you get? Because you asked me this yesterday. You said, do you have a set of people that kind of look over stuff that you do? And I was like, no, like, it just goes out. And it made me think, because your work, it's sort of steeped in literary theory and critical theory, continental theory, philosophy, anthropology, it must be a quite lettered coterie or a group that understands those sorts of texts, those sorts of ideas. So it seems to me like it wouldn't be just a simple, like, is it good or is it bad? But there's quite a lot of critical engagement, which might mean you get tied up in defending positions or explaining what you're doing.
I don't know. I mean, I think at some level I will never know what, you know, even my close friends sort of like really think. You get to a point where even like some of the more perhaps questionable and like automatic things that I'm doing in my work, which are a bit cringy to me even, I'm not entirely sure whether like they are sort of, yeah, I don't know. But I think, yeah, it's like you. I think with the rap thing now, it's that that media or sort of process lends itself to just going back and forth with someone, and I think that's what music's like better at facilitating that sort of exchange. Because I don't have any music journalism critical sort of like background.
Yeah.
It's just, oh, this is okay, and it provokes someone else to sort of do it, but in response. So there's a bit of a sort of a ritual, not ritual, but sort of like a game or sort of thing going on, I suppose.
When did you start bringing rapping into what you're doing?
Only like in terms of this in terms of like me orally performing it and trying to mimic it and having it, yeah, adopting the sort of format, I suppose. 2016, I think.
2016?
Yeah. But before that, though, there was always like bits of rhyming and sort of wordplay in my drawing and images. And even like characters, I'd sort of, you know, there's a, you know, sort of Tupac sort of thing going on for ages. So it's kind of been around. But the problem I've had or felt, again, it comes back to this suspicion is, like just seeing how to sort of talk about it in a suppose like an art school context, because I've come that's the background I have, and yeah, that was always the fun, like sort of weird challenge to sort of try and get the institution to sort of like give me some sort of feedback about that.
One of the things I think about the state of contemporary art at the moment is that we're in a really interesting transitional period, which is, I think, that maybe the mediums of art, the strategies for making, represent empty shells that it's useful for people to push ideas and aesthetics in that aren't necessarily developed from art historical canon.
Yeah.
And so it's almost like the institution is not capable of dealing with, understanding, and critiquing work that uses those mediums and those, like, let's say, theoretical shells in that manner, because there's no history for them to draw on. And so when you're talking about the difficulty in, if I'm understanding correctly, like the difficulty in bringing a sort of critically engaged art literate discussion to bear on rapping or certain types of work that you do, I would probably say it's because the history isn't there for people to fall back on. Like, right. You have to offer a discourse.
Well, yeah, I think like I agree with that, but I also feel that the point of maybe being explicitly saying, oh, this is rap, even though I'm not American, don't have a London accent, it's all of this other stuff and the vocabulary is different and the context is completely different, just to sort of signal that we're trying to make a connection between sort of a form of like expression, you know, creative sort of expression, which isn't, in my opinion, sort of like that disparate from contemporary art practice. Especially, I know, like, I live in Scotland, so, you know, the ballad tradition of, like, you know, Robert Burns is like the sort of on money there or something. So it's like, it doesn't take much of an imagination to make a leap between that kind of the form of the music, you know, but still, like, you know, I don't know what it's like in America, but definitely feel, when I was a student, that I'd not encounter many sort of like people making that kind of leap with that particular form of popular culture. Other forms of popular culture seem somehow agreeable to contemporary art practice, perhaps.
But do you think maybe it's almost sometimes rap has, it can almost feel like a form of gymnastics sometimes, in that what you are admiring is somebody's ability to navigate set forms.
Yeah.
So there's a limited amount of tropes that you can choose from and subject matter you can choose from. Not for everybody, but for quite a surprisingly wide number of people doing that form. And it's almost like in order to be recognised at that form, you have to conform to those set themes and tropes. And one of the things that maybe is upsetting what you're doing is that there's this weird kind of surrealistic play between like high and low culture, which doesn't sit easily in a discussion about those things. Well, it means you have to do some work as somebody who's trying to talk about it. It's hard just to...
Well, it's like, I think there's a fear of trivializing sort of like issues or violence or social, anything with a social conscience. I think like rap has always done that. It's really confused people. It's, you know, people, I think, you know, disgusted by it, a lot of it, or feel that it's sort of antisocial and all this stuff. But the whole sort of point of it is to like, I suppose, satire. It's supposed to sort of like poke at the way, you know, things are structured, and usually it's the power, I suppose. Like I've only done a little bit of reading around it, but there is some interesting stuff about like the origins of the of rap music, and in terms of like trickster sort of like gods and figures, and you know, it's really like it's actually quite you know, clear to me, really, that or becoming a bit more clear. So,
but yeah. Does rapping also function as like this medium that allows you to pull all of your interests together? I'm always interested in like the meta medium, you know, like
it's like because it's like I've approached like a video essay format before, and I think like, you know, a lot of the work it comes from annotating books or bits of experiences, you know, reflecting on them. And once you've got your own annotated like version of something that you're interested in, that's your kind, that's you, because that's you've selected it, and you've maybe, you know, got another level of annotation where you can say, oh, this part relates to this idea that I've had. And then I like the rap thing because it allows me to further condense that in a restricted form. And with sort of, yeah, I don't know, it kind of, you can say a lot in less, you know, in a shorter sort of frame or something. But I don't think it's, I think it's like now I'm just trying to work out if there's particular parts of a project that would benefit from being sort of like turned into sort of a rap thing, and whether other parts need to be like adopting another media. I'm not, you know, that's the thing. It's trying to work it out.
Yeah, because you work across like drawing, painting, sculpture, music, animation, video. How do you decide to move between each of those?
A lot of it's just to do with the destination, like the space or the who's sort of I'm working with in terms of the context, really. I think so working remotely, video is good to sort of use because you can sort of have a conversation or dialogue, communication with, you know, a curator or a person you're working with, by sharing bits of material like online. I don't know. I think every like year or two, I kind of would like to try and learn something new, technically, like a skill or something. I don't know what that will be next, but like there's within what I'm doing, there's scoped definitely, you know, there's lots that I haven't done. Like, you know, I've never really done anything in a studio properly. It's all been sort of like ad hoc bedroom sort of thing. And like different sort of producers and stuff like that.
So you grew up in Birmingham. What was it like growing up? Did you go to state school?
Is that like comprehensive?
That's
that one. I went to an all-boys school, actually, which I think is actually significant, but I've never really talked about it. And it used to be a grammar school, but it wasn't when I, was there. I don't know. I mean, Birmingham, it's like, I've never lived in London, but I imagine it's sort of similar, like in certain parts. It's small, obviously, but it's, you know, got sort of in quote like multicultural sort of like thing going on,
because that, I read somewhere that you were saying it was quite a disorientating experience, and I wondered mine was in London. Okay. Here, like, and I And I, so I wanted, I wondered how, in what way, I wondered if it was similar.
Well, disorientating in a sense of having sort of a parent culture which you sort of visibly can see that there's a sort of, you know, school teachers and my parents are like, they should be the same or something. That's ideally, that's what they should be saying. But like, I can palpably sense a difference between them in terms of like, and contradictions even, like in terms of, yeah. And it's like interesting to sort of observe, yeah, a parent culture not sort of fully integrating or benefiting from the sort of system, like in a way. There's that element. And then just like personally, like it wasn't particularly sort of a safe, well, it was a safe area to like be in. Quite a violent school essentially.
That's what I felt, because sometimes when people, well, in like popular culture, the representation of like an urban experience is one that's sort of gritty and staunchly realist. But what I saw in your work was this sort of weird hallucinatory element to that experience at that time. So basically, being young, going to school, yeah, there's school, and but there's also the threat of violence. And then there's also this weird mixing of different worlds. So like the parent world, but also the youth world, like the street and the home, they're really different spaces. And then like feeding into all of that is drugs, which like makes everything become this weird, gritty, urban, psychedelic experience. That in some ways I thought, wow, is this your work? Some of the animation and some of the drawing felt almost like a headspace that I was inhabiting at that time.
Yeah, and I think with the thing about the animations and the cartoons, it's like I used to watch a lot of, and it's like that sort of slapstick sort of, or it is verbal, but there's a sense of it being non-verbal to a point. You can watch, there's certain, I just think like I want there to be a sort of immediate, an ability to react and see things or look at it and assess it immediately without any sort of art kind of historical background. Obviously, it's an ideal thing to say, but I think that media and hopefully the sort of approach, yeah, I think my parents can look at that and like actually get something from it. Mm. You don't need to be told anything to look at it, you know, or something.
But I think maybe what I want to get you to speak to is like, I think in the middle or towards the end of the film, I'm just going to get this, the film called Confessions of Klabautermann.
Klabautermann.
I knew I was not going to be able to say that.
Well, it's a German word, so I'm not probably saying it right. It doesn't matter.
So that's a 2017 work. Yeah. And like, and then there's a passage in it, like there's one of these like, so in your videos, often it feels like you're going on a journey across this like animated tableau. Is that, could I say that?
I think tableau is great. Yeah.
Yeah, and then there's like a waving flag, and on the there's like a waving banner, and on the banner it says, "What is sublimate? What is what is desublimation again?"
Yeah.
And I thought, okay, yeah, this is desublimation. That was you playing with. And I was like wondering what was being desublimated at that time. Yeah. And it felt to me, is it that strange, odd soup of experience that happens in an urban environment, state school environment, where there's violence happening, but also all these different cultural levels coming together?
Yeah, is that what's being... I think it's interesting because I you know, it's like I'm still curious to sort of work out what order and a gallery would sort of like, in what order do they talk about those references? And it usually happens this, you know, British Sikh sort of thing. But like, the more you look at the work, it's got nothing to do, you know, it's got a Sikh representative is going to have trouble figuring out what the connection is. It's like very tangential on it. And I think when that happens, I think there needs to be like other ways of talking about it. But yeah. Then I think it's accessibility. But then I think actually then it can be a Sikh thing if we're willing to talk about the sort of relationship in that Sikh as a class has to the broader sort of Indian sort of society and what they were to like the British as these martial races, and you know, so you can get into it in another way, but I think just like the leveler Brit Sikh doesn't, it's not enough, but you know, I don't know.
I agree. That's kind of why I was not gonna draw you into that conversation or the identity conversation. What's it like to be here when elsewhere is home, or is there a tension between that experience or that idea? Because the work is beyond that. Although you can read that into it, you know, like we were talking yesterday, and we were saying, well, sometimes someone's interpretation of a work says more about them than the work.
Oh yeah,
and your work is ripe for that. It's almost like a Rorschach test, you know, the ink blot.
That comes back to the anthropology thing. It's like you know, I remember like that program Tribe or whatever that I used to reference a lot. Bruce Parry,
yeah.
Because you'd learn more about sort of what it was like for, you know, the RAF, former RAF pilot, to sort of like, you know, you learn about your own culture basically, or domestic culture rather than the supposed like remote.
And Bruce culture. Parry, just to say, just knocked your knee again. But Bruce, right. Bruce Parry featured on one of the jumpers.
Yeah, and there was other stuff that I did with him, but like before. Yeah, so it was like a knitted thing. But anyway, but it could be anyone, but I think, you know, the iconoclastic gesture of like, you know, reifying Bruce Parry, and a lot of people want to know who he is, you know, kind of. And then, yeah, I think like using references to provoke further conversation, you know, and that's it. It's like the artist is just like a sign pointer, basically. And that's what I want animations to be like, or the rap to be like. It's just sign pointing.
That's what it feels like. It feels like we're in semiotics again, but it's been reinvigorated. You know, like it's like on a tired field, but with what you're doing, you suddenly realise, everything's floating.
I see it everywhere though. It's like a trend, isn't it? Like of how an interpretation, how artists. You know, I've been in lots of like group shows and stuff recently, and I think the way that exhibitions are talked about, they're structured and organized, it's just like an order of, there's an order to like sort of say what things do and mean and what they relate in. I don't know, I think it conforms to what is going on, I think. So it's reactionary, I suppose. Making any sense?
Well, I want to talk to you about the boys' school. So, I mean,
I didn't think it was that weird until, like, you know, I grew up and like met other people and realized I was the only one that went to a boys' school. But I think it sort of made, I think this sort of, it just reflects sort of actually, as I said, my parent culture's weird adoption of like sort of Victorian values. and that's kind of stayed with me for a long time. And I'm not going to go into sort of detail to sort of like self-analyze myself here, but I think the characters have this sort of like, you know, I want there to be a sense of that. Like there's a tension within them because of this ingrained sort of thing, conflict.
But it feels like they could be, you know, the really competent, like textbook Daubins of someone who's but in like, that's not, you know, that's not to detract from the accomplishment of what you're doing, but it does feel like there's a link between the work and some sort of experience, and adolescent experience.
And I think I'm gradually getting there, and I'm a bit more maybe mature, but I think the trajectory, if there is one, would be to sort of like find a platform or an opportunity to, or meet a way to just like approach that sort of area a bit more. And I think it does tap into like sort of ideas of abuse really. But I don't know how I'm going to do that really yet. So, and what kind of, and how it will happen. One thing I might try and do is learn Punjabi properly, because I think the temple where I live is like, they do it for free. and that might be interesting, and that might be lead on to other things. I suppose it's just like, yeah, figuring out, having the time as well, and like the age and maturity to just, yeah. So I'm aware that that might happen, but I'm sort of just going through processes of like, yeah, doing things like this and like having fun as well. So.
And because your mum speaks Punjabi, it feels strange to ask you this question, actually. Like, but it's kind of, whenever I read stuff about your work, people are discussing this linguistic relationship between you and your mum. But yeah, it feels so like, such a personal thing, like for me to ask you about it. But I want to ask you about because you also collaborate with your mum on these sort of knitted pieces, like jumpers, sweatshirts, cardigans. Can I ask how that relationship works?
Because it's like, again, it came out of, you know, having, you know, growing up and like meeting other people, meeting my other friends' parents, and then them asking the normal question, so what does your mum do? What does he do? And then like it came out through that, those sorts of experiences. And then I would say, oh yeah, we don't really speak that much. The language isn't, you know, our ability to communicate is not the same. Mm. But also on top of that, I think with most people, they have a disconnect between the values perhaps of their parents or whatever. Well, there's a gap, generational gap, it's normal. But this is like a bit more than that because of the language thing. So I always knew that it was weird or significant. And I kind of know why. And that goes back to some of the more sort of, as I said, like the abusive thing that's a part of like a past traditional, inherited sort of like values, I suppose. But then I also thought, well, that kind of reluctance to sort of like want to learn English, or the idea that, yeah, within Birmingham, I'm sure the place in London as well, that communities can sort of like operate on their own sort of terms, wouldn't happen now. And, you know, and so in a way that's kind of interesting, really. Yeah, so I figured, and also like when I was, you know, Glasgow School of Art has a big reputation for their environmental and sculpture, so, you know, socially engaged and sort of working in different contexts and stuff. So I became quite familiar with that kind of language. Mm. And I figured, you know, potentially like my mum or my parents are a target audience for a lot of this kind of practice. And then I thought, why don't I just like sort of elicit that by making, why don't I elicit this conversation that we're having now by like physically like having a sort of objects made. So it's a process, like, really. I mean, since like I've learned how to do some of the embroidery now as well, and so I appreciate the sort of labour and have the ability to maybe like make some interesting things. But I think I just used that narrative, the anecdote, I suppose, to like to see if other people can share something or work and build up, you know, research perhaps. But it's like, it's just ongoing, really.
Mm. I think your work presents a view of quite a lot of challenges, you know. Oh. In a good way. Like what we were talking about earlier, the idea that there doesn't really exist a like readily available language for pulling apart what it is you're doing. And sometimes I feel like whenever you reach for one, you end up doing a disservice to the work in some way. If I start talking about psychoanalysis, I don't really feel that it's exact, even though we're talking about desublimation a minute ago, you know. And this is like when people make comparisons to your work and the work of Robert Crumb. Now, I think Robert Crumb's steeped in psychoanalysis, and obviously his brothers, if you've ever seen that film, I mean, they're full on in there. But I don't think that's what you're about, although there's an element of that in there. And the same way, when you're the work that's being made with your mum, like even the titles, like this piece, you know, by mum, I don't know. I feel like people are immediately going to think, oh, this is some sort of almost like an institutional critique thing about authorship and about who has the right to assert. And that is not it either.
No, it's not just one thing, I suppose. No, it's not just one thing. And I think it's like, but it is, there are certain sort of factors which are like concrete, I suppose, historical, like things which can help frame it, but it's always hard to diagnose sort of like the current situation. And that's why I probably refer to the past, because it's a bit maybe like easier to convey or communicate. I don't know, but I think it's important to sort of remember that, we are like living in the UK, and like we're in London now, but it's like, it's a, you know, there's lots of the world that I don't know about. So it's not that total encompassing, maybe. It's still a sort of product of, you know, a system of education and culture.
And one of the things I wanted to ask you about is the amount of references in the work. I mean, they're sort of incredibly complex. And I wonder what your relationship to critical theory, continental theory is, or just source material from literature
I'm quite scatty, actually. Like, I think, like, I will try and... I think I have a problem of imposing sort of my own ideas onto things as well. But I don't know. I think I am kind of able to maybe approach sort of reading and like research or whatever in a more conventional, not conventional, but more scholarly way. I don't think, you know, I don't write criticism like you. I don't approach sort of like, I think again, it's just to do with the nature of what an exhibition is, or what a piece of music can be, or what a film can be, or something. It's that's the destination, and that's why. And it's, I don't know, like, it's a bit of a, it's an experience. So it's like you play around with references and like test them out, but it's not like, I don't know, it's like, I don't feel like I'm want to repeat the references I'm making, or the text that I'm like, I'm not trying to illustrate something, essentially. But it's hard not to do that. And also, like, I don't think my sort of work at the present is, you know, it's kind of tricky to say, but like maybe not political in a sense that it's like about policy, changing policy, but really as well. So there's less to declare. But nothing to declare. it's just sort of a provocation.
Yeah,
provocation. Yeah. And like and hopefully other a catalyst for other provocations for other people. That's it. Right. But I also want to use the opportunities to like meet other people and like gain sort of knowledge and sort of experiences as well. So it's like art practice is like a way of just navigating your interests and meeting people. And from that sort of like, maybe you can sort of change things through that, through the people you meet, through like I don't know. Yeah. So it's, I think like it's kind of, I'm positive about it, but.
But there's also a kind of simultaneity that happens in your work that's not just about like you experience and stuff, is it? It's kind of illustrative of some kind of contemporary condition. And one of the things I've got written here, forgive me if it sounds super pretentious, but it is, the bench / seesaw as metaphor for the effect, affect of uncertainty or ambiguity that is produced in Hardeep's work. Like, must remember to ask Hardeep about that. So what I'm referencing there is like in the exhibition in front of the screen where you can watch four of the videos.
Oh, yeah.
There's a bench, but it's sort of almost like a seesaw. So if you sit at one end, there's two springs, and one you'll sort of sink down if someone, and that uncertainty of seating, and also that seemed to be reproducing the affect that I get from your work of uncertainty, of a type of productive ambiguity. So is it this, is it that? It's neither one or the other, and that's a kind of banal a lot of people sort of talk about that, like liminality stuff, but I don't mean that. I just mean you're in a zone where ambiguity becomes really productive on a number of different levels and a number of different registers.
Yeah.
So the most basic being, you can say, well, there's this sort of high puerility, and then, you know, so, and then there's also a kind of high literary theory, and they're both collapsed together using the devices of the pun, the metaphor, the simile.
Yeah, I thought it was just like a bit of an, you know, nod. I don't know. It's not, again, it's like you can, it's really hard now for like anything not to be put into a category, and one would maybe choose institutional critique for that one. And like, fair enough. But it's not really. It's just like the, it's just a basic sort of thing. It's like what happens when you have to sort of, you know, wait for someone to get off the headphones to watch a video. What do you do in that time? And does it affect sort of like, you know, your, I'm always trying to put myself into the impossible position of the first time sort of viewer, or that innocent sort of thing where I don't know why I'm here. I've been told to go to an art gallery by someone. Or the sort of, you know, the person that's not really informed in the same way, really, about, yeah, behind the scenes art stuff. So that's kind of what I want to maintain, that sort of connection. So I try and do things whereby you don't really need to know anything. You can just like figure it out yourself.
And why is that so important?
Just because it's like, I think it is important because it's to do with like, I suppose, like an idea of like class, I suppose, and like social mobility or something. It's to do with like, you know, and also to do with like autonomy or something. It's like to do with not being, yeah, you need to acquire other knowledges and knowledge and like sort of experiences and like develop and like be open and all this stuff, and like, but you also need to remember that why did you start making work, why did you do it, and what sort of experiences do you feel useful for other people to know about, I suppose, like
And why did you start making work?
I think like a combination of really sort of basic reasons. One was just the sort of pleasure of drawing, I suppose, and that's kind of like a cliche or whatever. And then the other, more so as I grew up, just to no one's done it in my family. It sort of seems to be like, I don't enjoy it, but like I've managed to like not get bored of trying to explain what it is to someone who doesn't know anything about it. Like, I don't know. I think it's just, I just don't want to be invisible, basically, in the same way that like, you know, like people, you know, sort of family members, like they work in the NHS or like have come from Navy or what, you know, it's like a service, you know, it's like, and I think, so part of it's the representation, maybe, and figuring out. Yeah, I don't know. Worst answer. Maybe ask me again.
Well, I want to ask you about class, because you just mentioned class then, and I know that one of the words that made me laugh most about you was the working class drawing you did at the beginning. So, why is class important?
Well, I'm struggling now to sort of. Say that there is, I don't know, well, the idea of sort of class structure is maybe less easy to sort of define now, because I think but I think obviously the defining thing for me perhaps is money. You're like, oh, how much money do you have? But still though, in terms of, I think in terms of maybe like intellectual access, I think sometimes that class has been a bit like distorted, the idea of a hierarchy. Yeah, just because it's like, it's the most important. So I think it's like the basic sort of thing that like determines, you know, the world and structures the world. So it's like, and I'm conscious of it. Yeah. And I think the art sort of sector, especially in the, I don't mean the UK, it's kind of, we got public funding, which sort of tries to mediate, but it's prevalent, the disparity, really. So it's a tricky thing because it's like, as I said before, I'm not approaching things sort of like scholastically. Is that a word? Yeah, so it's, I don't want to sort of, I mean, the fear of, the classic fear is like sounding stupid, isn't it? But so, but I don't want to sort of, you know, make a claim, but I just, yeah, I think it's, yeah, like it's the basic reason. I suppose you have to ask, why are you here? Like for me, it's like, well, because of, you know, certain historical things in the last 200 years, 100 years or whatever, which had to do with like the categorization, you know, people and their exploitation. And it's like, well, so it's, yeah, it's a knock on from that. And I think it's still palpable for me because of a parent culture that still exists. We'll be right back.